last agonising seconds, not just for Burns, but for his fans and his family waiting at the finish, and also for his team gathered back at the service area. But in true world champion style, Burns cocks a wheel through the last corner of the last kilometre of the last rally of the season to win the 2001 World Rally Championship.
You're the best in the world!
Richard Burns, 2001 World Rally Champion. How does that sound?
Sounds fantastic. Just drove like even worse than my grandma in the last few kilometres, but feels fantastic.
First marshalled on these stages in 1986 as a child, it must be an amazing feeling.
I can't believe it, I'm sorry. I've been thinking about it today, but how the hell do you can't imagine when you get here?
Done it. How does it feel?
It was fantastic. It was difficult in the stage. We just went slowly, but you have to concentrate 100%. So it's only when you cross the finish that it hits you.
It's been 3 years, real hard work to get this. You know, we signed Richard 3 years ago, and we said at the time, we can make you world champion in 3 years. And we've done it.
How great a driver is he? How great a world champion is he?
Absolutely one of the best. There's no question. And Richard's proven what we've been saying all along, that, you know, that his approach to it will make him world champion. He's not always the fastest on the first stage of a rally. He's not always leading at the end of the first day of the rally. But over a rally distance and over a season, his sort of measured approach, his judgment of the pace, makes him, you know, the deserved world champion.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Sprint Podcast. Before we kick off, we'd just like to dedicate this episode to the late Brian Patterson. Brian unfortunately passed away during the last couple of days, and anyone who's into rallying in Ireland or the UK will be aware of Brian's contribution to the sport through Rally News and through the Patterson Pace Notes function he did as well. So an absolute hero for a long, long time. You know, the Patterson van there, the entrance to service or whatever, was the many people's only way of knowing what was happening in the event. So I'm sure, like many others, I still have plenty of the old flyers at home from events. So, and there's always, you know, kind of a port call during the week, check out Rally News to see what the gossip was. So he'll be sorely missed, and our condolences to his wife Liz and their family and friends. So sad loss there. But as I said, we'd like to dedicate this episode to him. We've had a absolutely crazy response to the 9 McShay episode, the interview that Tommy did with him. It's been fantastic. People have seem to be really, really enjoying it. Niall was a great guest, and Tommy did a super job as the interviewee as well, so, or the interviewer as well. So that was brilliant. We actually made it to
It's like Jurassic Park. It's breaking all sorts of records.
Yeah, all sorts of records. I think we got to number one in Ireland on a few different charts and Apple podcasts and a few more things like that. So shout out to everyone there who's tuned in and left us feedback and comments. We really appreciate it. It's really, really good to see. We love doing it. So, you know, to see that people are enjoying it makes it all even more worthwhile. So thanks very much for that. Next week we have the Robert Reid episode. It's a really, really special one. So make sure and tune in for that. Some really, really good insight there and stuff that hasn't been heard before. So we've Tommy back on with us this week.
Hi, I'm here wearing a fur coat and a crown. Thanks.
Yeah, it hasn't got to him at all.
It hasn't gone to my head at all.
No.
My fee is in the post, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, she's the check will be bouncing all the way now, so don't worry about that. And William is slightly delayed. He may be, just technical difficulties, he may be joining us there shortly, hopefully. And we also have Jamie Arkell of the Gravel Crew. Hello, Jamie.
Hello. Thank you very much for the invite.
No problem. Anyone who's on Facebook, it's pretty much the only reason I'm on Facebook these days is the Gravel Crew group. It's a really cool community for just rallying in general, all you know, modern stuff and historical stuff as well. So it's super. It's about 90% memes, I think, a disturge.
anti-Citroen memes.
Anti-Citroen memes, yeah. And also, yeah, just on the subject of kind of random stuff this week. Anyone else see Mickey Biezo on any art?
Living the dream, like, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Simon Le Bon back in the 80s has nothing on him from a Duran Duran video. It's just unread, like.
His life seems to have been just on an upward trajectory even since he retired. Like, you know, he's fucking...
The best thing he did was go with that Cosworth, like.
Yeah. he just turns up there for the odd event here and there, drives in old Lancia, and back on the yacht then, and rest up. I mean,
he was at Rally Day like 3 years ago when it rained biblically, and he had a great time as well. You know, I spoke to him, he looked happy as Larry.
he was always kind of, I suppose, if we could say Marco Allen was the most Italian of Finns, could you say that Biezio was the most Scandinavian of Italians? Would that be a fair kind of assumption?
Cultural exchange we need to see.
Yeah. Maybe that was it. Maybe it was a cultural exchange program back in the progressive thinking from Lancia there. Good stuff.
He doesn't get the credit he deserves, I suppose, to be. I know, like, Lancia had a strategy of bringing in specialists like the likes of Jorge Ricalde, you know, for the rough events and the long haul events. But, you know, at the end of the day, he bet what was put in front of him, and he was a two-time champion, you know, which you have to say, you know, there's not, you know, it's fairly difficult to be a champion, and the world's a big place to be champion of it twice. It's fair bone.
I think everyone kind of just forgets about that early Group A period. You know, people just kind of, you know, my memory anyway goes from 86 straight to Turbo fans. You know, 91 Sirikas and stuff like that, you know. So that whole period in between with the narrow deltas and stuff is, even though, like, if you look back at it now, it's fantastic. Like, you know, it was actually really competitive. It's just that Lancia did obviously have a massive advantage.
I mean, probably 16 valve deltas are the best looking ones anyway, I think.
With no spoiler and stuff, yeah.
Pre Super League.
Yeah. I suppose, like, the early Group A days of, say, the Sierras and the M3s, I suppose, speaking from an Irish perspective of what we would have seen, and, you know, getting to see, you know, footage of these cars, you know, when they were on the World Championship, that was probably the most exciting end of things, to see these cars, you know, flame-spitting, wild rear-wheel drive cars. The Lancia has looked a bit pedestrian comparatively, but infinitely more effective, you know, but they had the advantage, but yeah. Still...
Yeah, I mean, I think that you guys got a bit of a crack of the whip of that, because nothing looks about as unspectacular as Sapphire Cosworth going through a British forest, generally. You know, it's very narrow, very linear.
Delacour was the only man that made a Sapphire look like it was actually even moving. Do you know?
And I say that as a massive Sapphire fan as well.
Yeah. They were just... They were a strange car. Still, you know, again, looking back, I don't know, they were really cool. But anyway, just before we get into the meat of the episode, our sponsor for this week is Exide Batteries, which would have been seen on Juha Kankinen's helmet and overall stroke 2001. So that kind of tidies up our unsponsor, would you call it? They're not actually sponsoring us, basically. I had to buy an Exide battery there last week for the business car on. Jeez, I didn't get a penny off it, I was sickened. But anyway, sure. That's the end of that. No more joke sponsors.
We fulfilled our contractual non-obligations.
Exactly. Yeah. So okay. So this is, here we are, round 14 of the season, the climax of the 2001 season, and, you know, looking again, the amount of hype going into this, with the two British guys fighting for the title, as well as Mackinnon and Sainz, it was just insane. Like, Jamie, obviously you were in the UK at the time. What was it like over there?
Yeah, I mean, it had been steadily building. I think 1999 was the first time I remember sort of hearing all this Battle of Britain stuff, which is always a bit silly, considering we all know that they were quite good friends generally, or certainly, you know, got on well enough. But it was only when I started, you know, doing some looking back prior to this that I'd forgotten how heated some of the exchanges became. And I'd forgotten that Colin suggested that that they might, Subaru should fit larger doors. Sorry, Peugeot should fit larger doors to the 206 in readiness for Burns' arrival, so he could fit his head into the car, and also so that he could chuck his toys out easier. Which is, it's pretty hot stuff considering, you know.
Ooh.
Yeah, I've forgotten how the specifics of it. And then Burns, you know, completely unflappable as ever, did his usual thing about, you know, Colin can only beat me on the road. I think I'll be quicker than him when it really matters. So, yeah, I mean, I think looking back, I always think Colin put on more of a facade when it came to that kind of sort of, you know, pre-event wordplay. And Burns sort of was a far cooler character.
Did anyone have a hype man?
What, at the time?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. We need Bez.
Yeah, just dancing in the background.
Or Cressa.
Yeah.
More maracas.
Yeah. Maybe that could have just sent them in.
Barney wants an E.
Yeah. But like I remember, like over here, even like, and this is pre-internet, this is pre-anything, and we would have been discussing it in school. Do you know, it was a big deal, like in the rallying world, obviously, but it had transcended, you know, into the mainstream there for a while. Like so, and like the amount of front page coverage, not just in the specialist press, like, but in actual, you know, mainstream media as well, TV, everything. Like there was like specials beforehand, you know, with Burns and Eurosport about the year to date and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's pretty much unheard of, you know, these days. Like, it's totally dropped off a cliff by comparison. So, like,
I think it helped that it was, you know, at the dawn of the digital age, and so it was still print was king. So if you wanted to find out about stuff, and if you wanted to read about this kind of thing, it was always a tabloid newspaper or obviously Eurosport, and that, you know, undoubtedly helped or crystallize the supposed, you know, antagonistic relationship between the two. Even if it all was just smoke and mirrors. And I remember it being all over, you know, the back pages of every tabloid going, full on, you know, Guardian double page spreads and stuff, because of, probably, I suppose, because David Williams was such a staunch supporter of Burns and such a good writer in the Guardian at the time. But yeah, no, inescapable in the run up to.
Like, I do remember that basically one of our major outlet to get WRC news was Motoring News, but it was once a week, so you'd be every Wednesday or Thursday, you know, waiting for somebody to bring it back from town when you came home from school. And with that, obviously, in Ireland, we had the post-event highlights. So almost the lack of coverage that we had in Ireland, almost every bit that you heard built it up that bit more. It was almost like the less you heard, the more it actually became a bigger thing, if that sounds a bit strange.
Yeah, we probably built it up so much in our own heads as well, because we were so young and so into it as well. You know, this was in my love for the sport anyway, my passion for rallying, this is the biggest thing that had ever happened, as far as I was concerned, in rallying. You know, in motorsport, actually, in general, to this point, pretty much.
I agree with you, Mars. I can't remember, you know, like I remember setting a tape to record on Video Plus or something the Sunday night of Rally GB, because I think it was on late on BBC Two, and getting up at 6:30 before school to watch it before I went to school on Monday morning. It was, you know, it's hard to put into words how pivotal this year was for all of us, I think, really.
Yeah, and like this is, again, you know, this all ties back into why we chose to cover this year for in such, you know, detail for this series of the podcast. It meant an awful lot to us, and this is almost the icing in the cake, as we see, you know, in the next over the episode. Things turned out slightly different than maybe we would have hoped in terms of, you know, the battle throughout the rally or whatever, but still, you know, it kind of almost adds to the tale as well, what happened. But anyway, we'll get there shortly.
It would take that it'd be the year that we'd really want to be big, that all of this would happen so quickly.
I know.
It does still feel very weird discussing, or to me anyway, discussing something that has, in the years since, accrued so much sort of mystique and importance. And at the time, I loved it and had a great time and I knew it was a big deal. But it's only since, for the passage of time, that it's sort of been, you know, I've realised how significant it was, you know, with enough hindsight and stuff and enough distance. It's very weird. It must be like how people, you know, who were there in 1986 remember it.
You were actually the only one of us that was at the event, Jamie.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'd been going to the GB at least 5-6 years by that point. My dad was a big McRae fan, so I inherited that. Still, you know, a big Burns fan. I was always about, you know, up about, you know, a Brit winning. But we were there to see McRae, or certainly my dad was. And we were on the way down the M4. I'd been allowed to bunk off work, off school on Friday to go. And we'd heard that Colin had balled the Focus on fourth stage. And that was the only time I've ever heard my dad say the C word ever. And it's the only time I ever did say it. I hear him say it, actually. indescribable, the atmosphere, getting there. Of course, it rained everywhere, constantly, pretty much without a break. That was fairly par for the course for that time of year in Wales. Just a wonderful experience, really, even if the sting went out of the title fight within hours.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to hear, like, and it's interesting, very interesting to see from the footage and the onboards. There had been spectator issues starting to kind of occur over the last couple of years prior to this. I guess this, as you mentioned there, this Battle of Britain thing was being so hyped that, you know, it was drawing more and more people. The cars were getting that bit quicker and people were getting, you know, a little bit brave. You still see it to this day. I've seen some fan footage from GB from the last couple of years and it's idiotic where some people are standing, but this year there was genuine spectator problems. Like, what was it like on the ditches that year? Did you feel, you know, did you get that sense?
In all honesty, I think it was better that year. But bear in mind, I was 13, so it's not like I'd have been completely clear. But I do remember it being particularly bad in 99 and 2000. The 99 was the first time I ever saw in real life someone jumping out in front of a car to take a photo and then jump back again, you know. And obviously, even at that age, I was aware of Group B and what happened, and it was fairly gobsmacking. But it was just before they'd started herding you into pens, you know, spectator pens. So you really could just park up in a muddy bit and just sort of wander in, like, you know, like we all enjoy doing. But
was it ticketed that year? Was there, or was it prior to the ticket?
It was ticketed, but I think it was still a reasonable £20 or something, you know.
Yeah.
I know, I was going to say, I think by like 2000, I remember going in 2004, and by that point, you know, again, my dad, bless him, was the one paying. It had become, they were trying to price it as a Silverstone equivalent. You know, I think it was almost three figures for each person for an event pass or whatever. And it's just, you know, you can't be charging people certainly that much to go into a feckin' Welsh Forest in November.
Absolutely not. Like, this leads us on nicely onto the next point. The character of the stages and the event itself. It's no wonder that, you know, if you look at the winners for the previous few years as a World Championship County event, McRae and Burns had won it every year since 94, I think, was it? Yeah, Swartz won in 96, but it was non-championship that year. And they had such, you know, a psychological advantage going into this event, those two guys, because they knew they had the knowledge of the roads to do it. Not necessarily they didn't know the stages and set up, but they knew the conditions better than anyone. They'd literally grown up in fogs, and, you know, they probably didn't see something until they were 20 years old anyway, you know. So it was nothing fazed them. So the likes of Carlos coming over, Carlos always had a terrible GB. Tommy never ever went well in GB.
He did all right when he got Subaru, didn't he? I think half decent results happened when he was in that Impreza.
I think, yeah, did he finished third? His final event was actually third
in 03.
03, correct, yeah, the year Petter won the title and stuff. But I think, like, looking at the four guys going in, you had McRae leading, Mackinnon second, a point behind, and Burns another point, and then Sainz was way, way back. He was only going to, you know, be able to win if the other three dropped out and he won, as far as I remember. I don't think any other result would have done him. Whereas the top three, you know, were basically going to have to just go for it from the start.
I mean, the top four were covered by 9 points, I think.
So that was it. That was it. Yeah, yeah.
He seemed to have resigned himself to that too, because I was looking at the interview with him pre-event, and he just kept referring to being tied for between the three guys. He didn't seem to be giving himself much of a chance. I think his role in all of this was now really to help Ford get the manufacturers. I think he'd resigned himself to it, I would imagine.
Yeah,
that's what the body language of the interview would have suggested.
I mean, I can imagine that from an M Sport Ford point of view, there was a feeling they really needed to get the championship, considering they looked to be, if not a shoo-in, certainly on course for it for most of the championship until Peugeot got their act together halfway through the season and started, what, you know, winning. They did. Granholm won twice before GB, didn't he? Finland and Australia.
Correct. Yeah. And then Panizzi had won in San Remo.
Yeah, so there must have been the sense that, you know, that the PSA challenge was suddenly coming out of nowhere, and what must have seemed, if not a sure thing, but certainly an almost certain thing, suddenly was slipping from their grasp. And obviously, by the first morning, it kind of had.
Yeah.
Another way that I'm looking at it as well is that Colin had not had a good Rally GB since, you could say, 1998. He was leading until engine failure. 99, couldn't seem to get on the pace in the new car, and ultimately crashed in the dark into Yanis Kulig's escort. 2000.
He did, actually. Jeez, there's a bit of obscure trivia. He did.
What a car to crash into.
It was a five right over jump in the dark, and somebody rooted out the footage there lately, or I think I was watching perhaps the BBC Top Gear rally reports from the time recently, and it was a horrible accident, but the fact that it was in the dark and the it just didn't seem to go well. But the following year, he was on the pace, had what appeared to be a fairly innocuous role, did enough damage to put him out. Like, and this year, to a degree, he'd had a brilliant mid-season spurt with the three wins and some good results up to New Zealand. Even to hold on to second to New Zealand was still a great result. But he seemed to have lost momentum at this point of the 2001 season.
We talked about it a lot in the Australia.
Australia must have, yeah.
I think that was so pivotal, and you know, it probably doesn't get the recognition it deserves. Mm. And it was such a
boring reason.
It's terrible. Like, he was much rather cool. Incident like a shark, it ran off of Nicky Gris pace note or something like that. You know, no, it was fucking Gary Connolly.
But you'd wonder with that as well. We touched on it there with the tabloid aspect of things of McRae versus Burns and Colin going for the slightly more boisterous way of approaching things. You'd have to wonder, was there a little bit of, at the time in Australia, Colin McRae was the sporting equivalents would be Tiger Woods, or in modern day football would be Messi. He was almost bigger than the sport. Was it a way of, you know, step back in line a little here? Was this their way of trying to tame him? I don't know. Yeah, no, we're getting into real conspiracy kind of end of thing with this.
Take off your tinfoil out there, Tom. Yeah.
I know, yeah. But
considering conspiracies are ruining the world at the moment, this is a good conspiracy. And that harms no one, 21 years out of date.
Yeah. But I think, though, Colin was probably under pressure because he hadn't had a good Rally GB for a while. Richard had that momentum also of some successful recent rallies as well. And
yeah,
it has to be said, he'd won the previous three Rally GBs.
1998 as well.
It seemed inconceivable to me that an Impreza wouldn't win. You know, I'd been watching blue cars win in GB pretty much since I'd started going, you know. I only ever saw one McRae victory there. Other than that, it was all Burns and Petter, you know. But yeah, some terrible luck previously, and making his own bad luck, of course.
That's like, if you look at it as well, the time, even the feeling even among the other crews was that Burns was actually the best bet for the title, which is interesting. I didn't. I only kind of reread the old copies of Early Exister recently, and did a little piece about who did the other drivers think was going to win the title, and a lot of them said Burns, which kind of says a lot for, I suppose, you know, where the sport was going as well, and this event, and McRae's approach to this event, it was kind of his last hurrah, I suppose you could almost call it. Even though he won twice in 0-2, he won the Acropolis and Safari, which were great drives in their own right. This drive, and especially that infamous onboard, I suppose, which we'll get to later on in the podcast, it was almost like a changing of the guard. So it's interesting to note that the other drivers were thinking along those lines as well. But anyway, just on the stages themselves, were obviously fully in Wales at this point. They got rid of the Mickey Mouse stages on the first day around kind of stately homes and that kind of stuff. They, I think 1999 was the last year of that, and it was just fully
South Wales.
Yeah, Cardiff and up into the forest after that. But then looking at the interest, really, really strong entry. Anything interesting there, Tommy?
Well, 117 entries comprised the Rally GB 2001, with a route of 380.86 kilometres, comprising of 17 stages. Of the 117 entries, wait for it, 39 A8 cars. That's 33% of the entry. And 18 of those were works cars. What I find remarkable about this is that we're post 9/11, and obviously there was a dot-com crash and other bits and pieces in the world in terms of finance that had a knock-on effect, yet there were still 39 of these A8 cars in the final round of that season, which I found phenomenal. Subaru entered four cars with Richard Burns and Petr Solberg being joined by Toshi Arai and Marco Martin. Pierre Oliatti was brought in again as a third car. Inexplicably, yeah, kind of.
Yeah, Pierre Oliatti, the known West Gravel Rally specialist. Yes.
Yeah, an avid fan of Welsh forestry, you know.
Absolutely, he grew up there. Oh,
he did.
He used to go on holiday and breakfast.
He used to stay with Joe Calzaghe's cousins there. Yeah. Nice Welsh Italian joke there for everyone.
Very good.
But Skoda also entered a third car for Rowan Cresta. Ford had Mark Higgins in instead of Francois Delacour. Probably worked well in twofold. Delacour was leaving, and also Daniel Gratton would not have recovered in time. But it could have been a tactical move for two reasons.
Interesting story behind Higgins' entry. He was due to have a works Ford drive for the 2001 British Rally Championship, which obviously got canned because of putting him out. And as far as I'm aware, I'm 90% sure, this was his sort of consolation prize, was the third car in GB.
Right. Yeah, that would make sense, all right. It would have been a good tactical move to have someone like that in the car to get in amongst the points, if need be, you know, to get between some of the other title contenders like Colin, do what he does.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. And interesting as well, Skoda and Hyundai, I think they were battling for fourth place, I think, in the championship.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, five Accent WRC started.
Yeah.
Which is unheard of. Incredible. Some sort of
record. Did he even build five at this stage?
Yeah, against three Skodas. And obviously, I mean, I think this is probably the best battle for the wooden spoon that we got. I mean, admittedly, because I remember being there and being absolutely blown away by Alistair with the rear bumper hanging off throughout the whole of the first day. I bloody loved that.
Yeah,
but it seemed really good. I mean, and again, I'm getting ahead of myself because of the events of Troskoid and Carlos Sainz. They all got promoted further up than perhaps they would be. But that whole battle for the championship, or the bottom spot between, was tied, I believe. Weren't they both on 17 points at the end of it?
Did somebody get? I'm just going to have a look at the standings. 2 seconds. Who actually got it? Skoda. I think. Oh, did they just?
Skoda got it on count back because of the third position.
That was it.
Monte Carlo and Kenya.
Very good. It was the fifth position. Sorry, not fourth. Sorry. Good.
Tommy Mäkinen, the only other change in the frontline team was actually in the Mitsubishi team, where Tommy Mäkinen was joined by Kai Lindstrom. They got rid of the punch bag, poor Timo Huntsman. And he was a human punch bag in Australia. Yeah. No, he really was. He didn't deserve that.
No, he really didn't. He got an awful bullying in Australia.
No one had as bad a time as him. But anyway, Kai Lindstrom was in to replace ultimately Risto Mäkisalo full time. From then, Kai Lindstrom actually very good track record behind him with Tapio Laukkanen previously in the BRC, as had. I think he was with Tapio Laukkanen before. I think Risto Mäkisalo was there as well.
I think Tapio Laukkanen holds the record for the most amount of mentions in this series without ever without beating in one rally this year.
Tapio Laukkanen, it's just fun to say.
It's fun to say, and he's a fun guy with a fun moustache, and it's all great.
And a mullet. Let's not forget that Tapio.
Oh, mullet, yeah, the mullet was strong. Yeah. Mullet was.
Let's
strong.
Get Tapio on in the next series. Let's get Tapio.
Let's aim for it.
Happen. Just insult his hair from 20 years back.
Yeah.
Tapio's a style icon, man.
It's Tapio Laukkanen's style power.
Yeah. They had an unbelievable privateer entry as well for this event. Gwyndaf Evans was entered in Sea Cordoba Evo 3. Probably one of the last times he was seen out in there, because I know he'd done a couple of small events here and there, and then as part of his safe contractual obligations. Henning Solberg was there, friend of everyone who likes Belgian rallying. Gregor Demevius was there in a 206.
I like Neil. Belgian rallying, he's not my friend.
Yeah, but you love Belgacom and all that kind of stuff and Atticus deliveries, don't you?
Are you actually friends, or are you just saying things now because your head's exploded?
I don't know. It's all in a dustpan brush in the corner. But there was a very...
It's all a blur. He doesn't even know what's going on anymore. What day is
I have it, no idea. It? It's gone. I've kind of gone Motley Crue 1989 spec here. It's just very bang. Very strong entry from a lot of the UK national entrants, guys that would have done the Nintex series, the likes of Steve Petch, Glenn Jones, Brian Bell, Julian Reynolds, and Stephen Harron from Northern Ireland, all out in the likes of World Rally cars and various AA cars like Impreza 555s, Irish Tarmac. Irish Tarmac.
555s for days, just like the No Big Thing.
Yeah. You couldn't get one now. They're as rare as rocking horse shit now at this stage.
You crawl across two miles of broken glass now just to hear one start up at this stage. Like they're gone so rare.
I would happily.
Yeah, I've done it. I have done. By the way, William has just joined us as well. I've just seen that, so he's resolved his technical difficulties. Hello, William.
Good afternoon, folks.
Hey, man, you're right.
Yeah.
How are things in your time zone, William?
Yeah, they're not too bad. Like, so I thought it was going to be much later. I thought it was coming in like a Teddy Sheringham impact sub here, but
be taking off. We'll take you off again before the end.
I'll pull a hamstring there at the end of day one. I'll pull McRae at the end of day one.
Go on, throw the oak into the trees. Go on.
Other interesting entries, I suppose, look, from an Irish point of view, two Irish Tarmac regulars, Eamon Boland and Derek McGarrity, were there in Impreza World Rally Cars. The Group N class in four, there were 40 entries. One of the interesting ones that I spotted was, if anyone remembers Colin McRae 1 on the PlayStation, you'd often see one of the works Mitsubishis you would be fighting in the AI drivers was this Kay Backlund. Well, Kenneth Backlund was there, so he's real, much like. Yeah. Another strong local entry in that, the likes of David Higgins, Jeremy Easton, Nick Ellsmore, Mike Brown, the XAIT works driver, Oliver Clark, amongst all the rest of the PWRC regulars, like Steve Longfist, etc.
Before we move on to the Super 1600s, we forgot to mention friends of the podcast, Neil Weirden and Trevor Agnew, were entered as well in the Subaru for GB.
Last minute deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, as mentioned in the previous episode. So if you haven't done so already, go back and check that out. And they take it through their 2001 season in great detail, so check that out if you haven't done so already.
And just on that, am I right in saying what car did they have? Did they have the latest spec?
They had an S7, yeah. They had an S7. Yeah. So that was
they hit a gatepost, didn't they?
I think so. They were going pretty well. Yeah, they had some decent times, and they were in the top 10. And just I think they broke the suspension off a gear post. So
But they were on Mark Higgins' pace. There was little or nothing between them on some of the stages.
Yeah. So no good drivers. Unfortunately, came to a bit of a premature end later on in the event. But anyway, so there was a lot of Super 1600 screamers, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was 21 entries for the JWRC, but ultimately 27 A6 cars. So in amongst the 21 regular entrants, the likes of Loeb, McShay, Stoll, Duval, the former Rally 2001 winner in the UK, Martin Rowe, beautiful looking rapid fit Puma Super 1600. There was no BRC that year, so Formula Rally took that place. Only other car that really stood out to me, and that was actually Kosti Kaczymaki started Polo. The event
yeah.
in the Polo. Yeah. Whether that was the same car that did Formula Rally, I don't know. But
I think it probably was. I don't know. Did he ever get any great results out of it? Rapid Fit was kind of an interesting sponsor for the Puma, considering, you know.
The BTCC livery as well.
Mandeo livery, yeah, and also the fact that he would break down on the trailer, going by many of the anecdotes from the time, not including Niall McShay's stories from last week. So,
yeah, he wouldn't be the greatest advocate of one. And to be honest, I've heard other stories, and not many people would give them that much of a ring endorsement.
The livery alone, though.
Oh, they were great. They were fantastic looking car. Brilliant looking. Yeah.
Nothing that's true, that's useless, can ever be truly beautiful. So that's the way to look at it.
Even the combination here, I mean, we all have a bit of a habit of having a gras for shit cars.
Yeah.
And I've owned nothing but shit cars as well. So.
The shit cars.
Odd cars in the entry, just to round out this dive in at the deep end. I'm probably going to get the bins here now. A5, there was two Micras and a Ka. The Ka was driven by somebody from that horrible newspaper, The Sun. Don't buy The Sun. Class A7 featured a Hyundai kit car driven by Graham Middleton. And there was three Seats, which one of them actually was entered by the RACC in Spain, driven by Danny Soda, who went on in subsequent years to win the JWRC. Yeah.
There's an interesting one there as well. The pronunciation now escapes me. I'm going to just give it I'm going to spell it out. TXUSJAIO. Chus Joe, I think. That could be his Carl Sainz Jr. team anyway. In a
from East Anglia.
Yeah, in a Sepsa-backed Focus.
I was afraid of pronouncing that. But
you just ignore that. You ignore that massively interesting entry just because you couldn't. It's fine. Yeah, I'll yet again. I'll pull you out of a ditch. Don't worry about it. Let's move on to the event. William has finally got going out of Park Fermé, so we're all here, so we can kick off.
Is he getting penalties now?
Pushing out of Park Fermé, yeah?
Yeah, he's 25 minutes late out of Park.
Did he get outside assistance?
I'll be putting in an appeal, you can be sure of that.
Yeah.
I saw you drive down the wrong way in the road section.
Oh, he's admitted it.
You're in no position to be making an accusation, Tommy.
I'm above the law now. I can buy my way out of anything.
Yeah. Was Burns' controlled panic?
Was that
spark plugs? Wasn't it
when
first
he had
morning,
to push himself out? Yeah.
Was that Friday morning or was that Saturday morning?
That was Saturday morning. I was going for the Park Fermé thing.
Yeah. Actually, I'll go with that excuse. I had the plugs that would get Burns on Saturday morning.
Very good. That was it. Yeah. You got a second hand one. So very good. Anyway, let's get into it. So kicked off with a super special in Cardiff.
Fucking awful.
Were you at that?
Cardiff Super Special is one of the worst places in the world. I mean, you know, I've lived in Cardiff. It's a great place. But that, before they developed the docks, was just like, it was like a stage in the Somme or something. It was just bleak and flat and windy and cold and wet. And I was watching Mackinnon take every corner off the back of the Mitsubishi. Is he?
Yeah,
he really
slapped the air in the first corner, didn't he?
He was trying to make it out more aerodynamic. He was rounding
it out. That was the best they could come up with in terms of air development. Yeah, actually physically damaged the car.
do you know his strategy probably was? Probably back, was it 96 where he took the wheel off? I said that was his strategy this time. He goes, right, if I knock a rear wheel off, I get a phone call afterwards saying I'm world champion.
That was the famous Hillman Imp thing in Millbrook. Yeah.
You can tell us this now as someone who was there. They quoted us on the commentary of the TV review of it. Of 15,000 fans were there at the car, the super special at the docks. Were the crowds anywhere near that, or is that a bit of an exaggeration?
I think that's absolute nonsense, to be honest. I mean, it was you weren't exactly close, which is understandable, I suppose. But no, I mean, it was, my memory is that it was really poorly organized, big traffic jams, fairly featureless, and
God, I love that.
I was coming at it from having experienced something similar at the when Silverstone had that Roger Albert Clark stage, the one that they used in 97 and 98, which was a whole lot better. I couldn't tell you how many people were there at all, but it didn't seem at all packed.
Yeah, sounds like fun.
And to be fair, I mean, it's very hard to get a good super special stage. I'm not a fan.
I think Silverstone did, though, come bloody close to it, though.
Yeah.
It did seem to look very good from a TV point of view. And I know people who went over to spectate it, and they said it was good.
Yeah. It is a hard thing to get right. It's, I don't know. And again, a lot of the crews hate them because you'll never win a rally on a super special, but you'll often do enough damage to finish, as we've seen throughout the year. So.
Gary Massey, that fella hits,
man. Mäkinen ended up 18th quickest for that service.
And they put the crews together, didn't they? They did Mäkinen and Sainz side by side, and then did McRae and Burns, wasn't it? And McRae was quickest, but as you said, Mäkinen was way, way back and just hopping the car off everything. Just looked totally ragged.
Listen, didn't it look funny, you actually, off the start line with McRae and Burns, how much quicker the Impreza was off the line? No, not Toyota quicker off a super special line.
something Langley Park.
Yes, something turbocharger.
Keaton Bassett reference here.
Yeah, McRae, I don't know, even despite that, McRae still got the quickest time at the end, so maybe he just kind of slightly bogged on the start, because back then, I don't think every car had like the super duper launch control that they would have had in the mid 2000s, where it was, you know, basically press a button on the wheel, hold your foot on the brake, and on the throttle flat, and the car will do the work. I think there was still an element of clutch control involved here. So, and you would see the odd time cars bogging up a start, even in this era. So, and it wasn't due to lack of power or anything like that. It was, you know, technique from the driver. So, just an interesting one to see. So then that brings us on to Friday morning, and I suppose looking at the coverage, Jamie, you might be able to verify from being there, but it was quite unusual. GB conditions looked to be pretty dry and almost sunny. I wouldn't say warm, but you know, it was no rain there on Friday morning, and you know, the crowds were just crazy. Like, there seemed to be half of the UK lining that second stage. That's probably one of the definitive rally on boards. I think McRae is on board from that stage. I think we know. It's probably the one if you're chatting to someone and you wanted to show them why you're into rallying, it's one of my go-to ones, I know, I think. You know, it's mind-bending. How over the limit he was there, it was just insane. Every corner seemed to be...
What I love about that, Morris, is like, even when you still watch the onboards of it now, like with the angles he had that car at and how much he was holding it, during on the absolute limit of the slide, you're normally waiting to get it back. How long he was holding the car on those, it's just mental.
You know, it's really good onboard footage when it almost looks easy. Like, it just, the car simply flows from one bend to the other. You know, it's no big thing. And fantastic.
We're actually just going to play a clip from near the stage end. Just have a listen to this and just listen to how hard the car was going.
To rest. And long, six left, open. Six crest, into six left, and six left over crest, into six right, and six left over crest, open 70, six crest 50, six right over crest cut, into six left over crest, don't cut, and six right, 50. Six crest into six right. And six crest, 50. Six right, cattle, crest, keep right, and six left, 50. Six left, opens. 35 right over crest.
Tell me, what's your theory on McRae's approach on the Friday morning?
Well, clearly, like, look, we've discussed it already. He probably had an element of pressure on him because of the fact he hadn't had a good rally in GB in a number of years either. But I think the recent form of Peugeot definitely would have lit a bit more of a fire underneath him, because clearly the Ford didn't have the legs of the Peugeot in places like Finland and ultimately in Australia. It didn't, but other factors come into play there. He was taking huge risks in that stage and driving beyond the limitations of the car. Now, it has to be said, phenomenal car control, unbelievably phenomenal car control. But he had a couple of notes in there. He had five right, I think, towards the end of the stage, and it was a very ambitious five. Like, it was a four, what I would normally grade it, even by, you know, the angle system. An extraordinary piece of driving, amazingly on the limit, but I think driven by the fact that he probably had to try and beat the Peugeots. Because when you look at the times, Marcus Granholm and Didier Auriol weren't far behind on that stage.
McRae, if you look at that on board, right, and I think I wrote something about this before, to a similar point to you, Tommy. If you looked at that on board, like, it's like as if you or I would play on a computer game, only we wouldn't actually get that far. We'd end up hitting New York about 10 times and resetting before we get to that. He'd one go off that stage at that speed with those basic notes, and they were basic, because if you look at Burns on board from stage four, it's a fascinating comparison from, you know, two guys and their different approaches. If you ask somebody how much quicker was McRae than anyone that stage without knowing the results, you'd say 20 seconds. You'd say there's no way anyone is even on the same minute as him. But as you said, Granholm was 1.8 seconds behind. And Granholm, who was quickest on stage three? Granholm.
But okay. I think though, if you had to get access of Granholm or Auriol's on board from that stage, it wouldn't have been half as wild. Because I don't think that the Peugeot had to be driven to that limit to set that time, whereas the Ford probably did.
No, it was.
The Ford was beyond its development stage, I'd say, at that stage. You know, it was. Passed out at that stage.
The car was moving a huge amount as well. On the bumps, the back of it, the travel doesn't seem to be there or something. It actually kicks the back up quite a lot.
Remember we were talking about this earlier in the season about his approach, particularly on events where he'd try and knock it out in the Friday and psychologically beat everyone. Like, I wonder, definitely a combination of overdriving a car that wasn't capable of being the quickest, and two, you'd wonder, was there an element of a mind game element here of people seeing how hard he was driving and trying to put that into the rest of their heads, kind of going, Jesus, if McRae's going that hard, what's to come?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Because you can even remember, like, Burns talked about it there, and he said he always mentioned the comment of, you can always predict when Colin's going to go off. You can see the lines he's taking, and when you're on the limit and his lines are 2 or 3 foot wider, you know he's absolutely, you know, brain out, helmet on.
There's a couple of points in that onboard where towards the latter third of the stage, in some of the sweeping corners, that a couple of inches wrong and it was going to be a mammoth accident.
Yeah.
Because of the inputs and the weight transfer that he was using to, you know, carry the speed through the corners, because he was compensating, I think, to be honest, for the shortfalls that the car was making. But equally, as we see in Carlos Sainz's onboard later in the footage, the crowds were standing in some ridiculous paces for the pace that the likes of McRae that were coming through at. But it has to be said, you have to take your hat off. A phenomenal performance to set that time, but it probably exposes more the shortfalls of the focus than than anything else, because the Peugeots were able to set the time, and you can be guaranteed that neither of those drivers were taking the risks.
And Tommy, a shortfall in McRae's approach a lot of the time.
And he didn't, you know, the biggest thing, I mean, fair enough, it was impressive, but he didn't need to do it.
Exactly, isn't it?
That's the most frustrating thing. You know, even as at the time as a diehard McRae fan, it's like, just turn it down a tiny wee bit.
Yeah.
Were you at any of those stages on Friday morning, Jim?
No, I was on the way there. I'd taken, been allowed to take the day off. The first one I got to was Cricken, which is why my dad was so distraught. You know, I got there just in time for it all to be over in that respect.
That's a good point, Jamie, you made there. You know, he didn't need to. He needed to beat Burns. Stage two was pivotal for Mäkinen and Sainz, in that Sainz got a puncher, lost a heap of time, ended up damaging a brake line as well, so lost even more time in subsequent stages because of that.
He got a time and penalty as well after that as well.
I think he was late on a road section as well. And Mäkinen didn't even get to the end of the stage. Mäkinen got to that near that point where we've the clip from McRae there, where he's flat in sixth for what seems like about half an hour, and he hit I didn't even see what he hit. It was like a log or a rock.
Have you ever seen a more innocuous retirement ever? Yeah. That left hander was just nothing.
What did he even hit? I didn't even see what he hit, but that was it. It pulled something out of the suspension, and he himself
described it as a pothole or something. I watched it, and he looks like he's on the verge of tears when he's down by the front left wheel arch. So, you know, saying sometimes rallying is hard, but later on they press him on it, and he says, I think he said it was he didn't say pothole because I'm sure that doesn't exist in Finnish vernacular, but you know, it was just a tiny little imperceptible depression, and it just ripped the front off. You know,
he made some comment about the rally itself, rally GB itself. He said, this rally sometimes very difficult, which is probably the understatement of the year, really. You know, his title was gone. Like, you know, and I don't know, would Tommy have actually done it? I don't think so. I don't think Tommy would have got this.
It's hard to see him at the end of day three being in contention, but even like James' point there about the emotion in his face, he's actually holding back tears, trying to compose himself to talk to the camera. You can imagine how frustrating that was.
Mm.
But had Mäkinen stayed going, right, when obviously we know where everyone finished up in the rally. Had Mäkinen finished the rally behind Burns, a point behind, and which would be feasible, you know, because you'd imagine he would have the legs of some of the guys, he probably would have got it on countback.
Yeah, with the wins and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's possible.
But if my aunt had balls, she'd be my uncle. So
exactly, you know. Exactly. So look, again, but again, it's just another kind of what if, one of, you know, numerous ones throughout this season. But
can we give the real reason why it happened? What was his replacement co-driver? It's definitely his fault.
No, we covered that already. If you turned up, if you got going to the park for a million time, you would have heard that. Kyle Lindstrom was in. Can't be bad, Mountain Kyle. Kyle Sound.
Still his fault.
Kyle Sound.
Gwynne also saw Liatti and Solberg go as well, didn't it?
Solberg had fuel pump issues or something, wasn't it? Yeah.
What I love about the footage of Solberg is him getting absolutely pelted with gravel off a Super 1600.
yeah. It's a very us thing to appreciate, right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think any day I was going watching any forestry rally in Ireland.
Yeah. What happened, Liatti? What happened to Liatti, Jamie?
A transmission issue. I think it's diff just shot itself, the centre one.
Was that because he insisted on using a Tarmac setup?
Well, hopefully. I'm trying to replicate the success in 97.
Yeah, he was like, why is this car on 15-inch wheels? I need... You know? He was fully sure. Anyway, yeah. Good old Liatti. But anyway, on to stage three then. And like, you know, Burns had passed. Mäkinen pulled up on stage two. He would have been aware at that point of Sainz's issues. So, you know, at this early point in the event, it was already pretty much a two-horse race, Burns and McRae. And, like, it's interesting if you listen to, I know we've referenced it numerous times, but it is a brilliant podcast, and please go check it out, Nicky Grist with Chris Harris. Mm. Nicky does mention that Colin was quite stressed that morning. He felt, even though, you know, he'd done that spectacular drive on stage two, he felt that he wasn't pulling enough time out of Burns, he didn't need to, as you said, Jamie. He did, you know, there was no need for it. Was just, again, this is the way the guy was. It was just his approach.
I mean, they always get that old hoary treat cliche about, you know, drivers saying that you crash when you're trying to drive at 98%. And I get that. But still, it was the most frustrating thing about Colin. And I always think it was, you know, he rejected a lot of the anxieties he felt by trying to sort of have this overly bravado approach to it. And, you know, maybe it's an easy thing to say now with so much hindsight and so much time, but it was immensely frustrating to watch.
Yeah, you crashed at 98%, but you also crashed at 198%, which is what stage two felt like when you watch it.
But to add to the frustration as a McRae fan, when you look at how well judged his performances had been at certain points of the year as well, you know, like in fairness, but even in this year, he, like, one of his best performances in the year that gets overlooked, there's two of them. New Zealand and Finland, and like Burns had a better road position and made it work for him. McRae didn't have that good road position, but he still managed to keep himself in the fight. In Finland, he didn't have the car to take on the Peugeots, which, as we've alluded to, may have proved a bit of his undoing here too. But he was able to play the long game, which ultimately that approach may have been the wiser one when we look at this, but it feeds far too much into this myth of the if and doubt flat out. It just it perpetuates this thing and kind of blows it up even more, the fact that something like this happened. Because in reality, like, we've done our bit this year to kind of try and dispel that a little bit too, because I do think there was more to him than that.
I know we get to the last rally and he just takes all that and throws it in the bin for us.
It's interesting that, like,
even from the McRae camp, why even at that stage, into stage three, was there no one sitting there talking to him going, Colin, look, there's 2.5 days left, relax?
There was, Nicky Grist, and he said it to him, I think.
It's interesting that, like, you can sum up McRae's career. There's two images, and it's donuts at Chester Racecourse and that crossed arms thing going end over end halfway through SS4. Like, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, stage three, looking at the times from stage three there, Granham was quickest, Ariel was second. Ariel was obviously suddenly deciding to wake up after being asleep for a lot of the year. They kept him happy by putting the 6-speed box in, and he suddenly remembered how to drive it again. So
what a splash is to crash into and ruin his Toyota this time around.
Exactly. No, yeah, he couldn't drive. What was the quote again? I've never seen anyone drive so badly to win a world title.
Yeah.
Is that the quote at the time? Yeah,
absolutely.
He's gotten an awful time on this podcast this year.
He didn't get a chance to wear sunglasses either on this round.
Yeah, he's earned every bit of it.
He was shocking in the opening leg of 94. But anyway, sorry, I digress.
Anyways, and Burns was third quickest on stage three, and McRae was in fourth. And as I said, Nicky Grist was trying to calm Colin Doan going into stage four. But, like, looking at this off, right, it was so unnecessary. I mean, he was pushing mega hard. He was pushing every bit as hard as he was in that stage two. I'm sure he was pushing crazy hard in stage three as well. He still had 0.2 seconds of a lead or something like that going in. But he was ahead of Burns. That's all that mattered at this stage, was just finish ahead of Burns. And they went in, I think it was six left into five right, and then a five or six left cut. But there was a huge hole on the inside of the five right. And I don't know, this might tie back into McRae's notes, maybe not being as detailed as they could have been. Again, they hadn't marked it as an issue. I think you might have been aware it was there, but you didn't see it as big an issue as it would turn out to be. The car... Yeah,
hasn't he said that in the past? You heard his interviews when he was looking back over it. When he said he looked, and he said it was one of those things where he looked and he said he had space and time to correct it, but just chose not and just chose to go with it.
Yeah, and that was it. The car went in, bang, and that was it. As Nicky Grist described it, trees, sky, road. Lucky enough, they were both able to walk away. I think McRae's vision might have been a small bit blurry afterwards. It was a very, very high-speed crash. You know, it was the top of fifth, basically. So not fair off 100 miles an hour.
Actually, Morris, as you say that, right, I actually just had the clip open in front of me here again. And as you mentioned that, you can see McRae grit his teeth on the entry to the corner.
Do you think he might have maybe realized just before he went in this? We're in trouble here.
Because if you go from the POV camera here, it's just a time to have on here. And yeah, you can see it. But then if you pair up the steering movement to when it switches to a face, he's still about 20, 30 yards away from the point of impact. And you can see him just going cheeks out, teeth out. And you can see him going, oh no.
Yeah.
I'm actually watching it here now as well at the moment.
Pull that up there. When it goes into the slow motion camera, you can see him just at the start. He just grits his teeth.
He was very lucky that he did it in an area that had been felled on the right-hand side. Because he went way out into the scrubland, if I remember rightly. You know,
he did, correct. Yeah.
Well in the woods.
As you look at it here, he's coming through a fast five left, and it's just, you can see the speed is building, and the approach in, you can see, comes in, just cuts in too late, the hole is inside. Burns, afterwards, you can see in the onboard, he's talking back to Robert Reed. Burns had spotted the big hole in there. He knew it was there. And it just boils back to what you're talking about there, Morris, that McRae knew it was there, but chose not to put it in. You know, like, it's the fine margins. Like, and you look at the car being tossed around, and they're inside like rag dolls with the harnesses on, just being tossed around the place. In the days before Hans devices, the guys were extremely lucky. And as you say, Jamie, they were lucky that the forestry had been felled. A side on impact at that speed, you know.
Not good. Well, we all know how that ends.
Yeah. No, and like, this is like McRae, I suppose he knew there was no point even trying to start the thing by the time it stopped. You know, he said himself he knew that this is it. This is the championship pretty much gone. Bear Burns, you know, being spirited away.
To be a fly on the wall of the M Sport trader at that point, considering Sainz presumably was what, down outside the top 10, and you know, a manufacturer's title just completely gone up in smoke.
It was not the nicest atmosphere inside her, but this was it for McRae. Again, to me anyway, this was his last chance. And it was to prove out to be that way, but the sport was already changing. He wasn't changing with it. We saw him in 2002. He had a pretty lackluster year in 2002, and then into the Zara in 2003, and it just never worked for him. He was still the sport's biggest draw by far, but he would never get to this point. You know, the point where he was in contention for a title again. He had this one.
I mean, the risk of opening up like a complete barrel of worms, we'll never know whether, if he'd had the opportunity at the time and the inclination to adapt to sort of the modern world or the, you know, the mid-noughties world rally car, whether Colin could actually have adapted that to the same way that one of the younger guys could. I doubt he probably could have, because he struck me as someone who wasn't. It was quite uncompromising.
I was kind of thinking about that, Jamie. That's actually a very good point about, like, let's face it, he was at the back end of his career, changing a generation of driving stuff.
Mm-hmm. Group A driver.
I kind of disagree, because McRae left the WRC at the age of, I don't think he was long gone, 34. You know, not an old age for an athlete in motorsport, at least not in rallying anyway. And like, he proved to a certain extent his versatility in other things. Like, he raced the Ascar at Rockingham, and he's been more than successful in the Pro Drive Ferrari 550 Maranello at Le Mans. But I do agree with you that it is one of those big, we will never know, would he have adapted? I'd like to think that he would have, because at the end of the day, if you can drive, you can drive. And, you know, the man could drive on any surface. But
he's handy in the Skoda.
He was very quick in the Skoda. I just think, guys, from my own opinion, just looking at it and looking at what happened subsequently, this was it for McRae's style. He was his approach with the way the notes were going, with the way the cars were going, with the way the whole professionalism of the sport was going. This was it. This was his last chance. I stand by that opinion.
Yeah, and but you'd wonder, like,
no, why, I agree with you in some aspects.
But was this more defining for McRae than him actually winning the title in 2001? Do you know what I mean? It's like one of those things. Like, obviously, it gave Burns his title, but it also was such a huge moment for rallying for McRae to go out and blow the title. Like, instead, it kind of it probably depicted his career and style more than winning the title.
I mean, that's one of those points that only becomes apparent, I think, with the passage of time. You know, it's only now that you realise how iconic and important that was. And you're right. I think it almost, in its own way, overshadows Burns' victory in terms of popular consciousness, Burns' championship. Mm.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It does. And like, as you know, the sport was so different from even 1995 when McRae won his title. The cars were gone. Had changed so much. You know, the rallies themselves were, you know, the character of them had changed in a lot of ways. The competition had upped. Now, I don't think anybody could, on his day, on a stretch of road in a car that needed pure talent, nobody was going to touch McRae. He was the ultimate, what you call a reactive driver. His car control was...
Neck.
Yeah. I don't think anyone, you know, up to that point probably had the edge in him in car control. Probably one of the most talented guys behind the wheel of a car of all time. But that wasn't enough for the sport at this point, and Burns' approach was becoming the way to do things, as we saw. Granham's approach was similar enough, and we all know what happened subsequently. This really was kind of a real important bookmark in the history of the sport, I think.
Would any of you take the point or the stance with McRae that having come so close and ultimately, it's funny, we talk about it, and, you know, Morris is watching it and I've watched it here, and I've forgotten how angry I was at work that day when I heard about it. I was angry because it was just, but you can imagine our anger as fans, but, you know, like, his anger and how that, it could work in two ways for a driver. It could really motivate them going forward, or could knock the wind out of their sails completely. And I wonder, was McRae ever really as motivated from that day on?
Yeah. And even kind of going back to Morris' point there about kind of a pivotal year in terms of the timing of, we said, the changing of the guard of how guys were competing at that level was probably the culmination of his frustration of not being able to adapt, and then this is literally kind of closing it off, going like, it's your time's kind of up really here.
But and as well, like, when you look, you see Peugeot coming, they have a better car, you're already tied into a contract with Ford for the following year in a car that, you know, you're beaten before you started, unless you go to the rough rallies. That's your only chance of beating them on pure speed. This car can't do it.
I don't think he was as psychologically resilient as maybe we all thought at the time, and that's no, you know, that's no slight on him, but it's, you know, it's interesting the amount of mud he did sling in comparison to Burns. And Burns just got his head down and sort of got on with it, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, Burns had, you know, the confidence in himself of what he was doing. He knew exactly his approach. He believed 100% in his approach. I don't know if McRae, you know, had that. Obviously, he had the confidence that he could go down a bit of road quicker than anyone else, but that was sort of his, you know, that was the only strength to his bow in a way. You know, he didn't have the level of tactical notes that Burns did, or, you know, he didn't have the strength with the notes to adapt to the different conditions. Like, you know, we'd seen it even a couple of years previous when Richard took a minute and a half out of him in the fog, you know. And was it Rhonda, I think? And you know, that stuff will, you know, that is going to get into your head. So that's an interesting point you've made. The kind of the bravado and the mudslinging, as you say, you know, that was a defense mechanism, I suppose you could say, in some ways. But without getting too, so,
yeah,
too deep into the mental side of it, because, you know, it's all history now at this point. But an absolutely pivotal moment in the sport, that caught on that 5 race. That was huge.
And then Burns went on a few corners later, didn't he? At a junction, like completely sidewinded by the entire thing.
He went backwards into a pile of logs and saw the car, got back on again. And there's actually an onboard on YouTube. We'll link all the relevant clips as usual whenever we post the stuff on social media. But he gets to the end of the stage and turns to Robert Reed and just kind of taps him on the knee. You know, there's nothing said for a minute or two. And I think Robert just goes, fucking hell. And as you said, William, he mentions that so he was off there on that five right, there was a big hole. He's just gone too far in or whatever. I think the guys, you know, so we've Robert on next week and he'll be able to relate in much, much greater detail than we will this week, what happened. But pretty big feeling for those guys, you know, with 2.5 days of the rally left to go. They were on course for the title suddenly. You know, this massive, massive battle that had been so hyped leading up to the event was now gone. This was it. Burns only had to finish fourth or higher and the title was his.
That must have put its own pressure anyway. You know, it's yours to lose now, isn't it? Talk about, you know, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory and all that.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
As you said, they're a bit of a touchy situation to be in. You're like, all right, all I have to do is not do anything stupid, and all that has to happen is nothing go wrong with the car. Yeah. That's very easy to say when it's not rallying.
But you see with science as well, like, you know, a couple of years ago, like in the same situation, Carlos Sainz,
and presumably wasn't helped by the fact that his teammates in practice, apart from Tosho, has kept just going up in flames or.
Actually, just on Tashi's car, did anyone, I think it was on Roman Chris's car as well, did anyone spot there was like this pod on the roof of those cars? I don't know, was it something to do with the upcoming Channel 4 kind of virtual spectator stuff or something like that? But I think
it's a grey pod, is it?
I don't know what it was.
Those cars carried them the following year. Was it in Marsat?
No, this thing though was huge. This thing was like half the length of the roof, and it was kind of situated. No, it was streamlined. But it was positioned behind the roof scoop and ran.
Nothing on the Octavia was streamlined.
Yeah, I know. That was actually the most streamlined bit of the car was this extra thing they put on.
The budget.
I give my theory on it that they were well ahead of the 03 Focus with the pressurized gas tank and the bumper ahead of them.
Yeah. Scott, I got a second of my load of this random addition to the roof.
Those two podiums are down to that.
Yeah.
it was an extra fuel tank due to the weight of the car.
Yeah. If anyone knows, anyway, you might let us know. Any listeners there, you might have some insight into that. Because seeing stuff like that and wondering what the hell it's for.
The rally kept going, didn't it, though?
The rally kept going. Granholm went into the lead, and that's kind of what happened, really, to the rest of the event.
Whoa. Marco Martins and Pretzer caught fire. Let's not, you know.
Yeah. Did you hear what Marco Martins said? Something must be really broken.
It
doesn't matter. I'm going to Ford. Funky.
That's a very correct engineering term. Like, it's either fucked or totally broken.
Yeah, very broken. That's just broken.
It was a piston to valve interface issue.
Interface issue. Nicely put. But anyway, so as I said, you know, the signs have been there on the last few rallies that Peugeot had really got their act together in terms of reliability and pace, and with the car always at pace, I just couldn't get to the end of the rally. But now this is it, gone home, and the boys were left off the leash to kind of take control. Because day two, nothing much really happened, and Elsa,
before we move on to day two, Mars, on the end of day one, you had fairly good finishes for kind of top local, as there with Mark Higgins in 7th. And yeah. I said the lads, Neil Wearden and Trevor Agnew in 11th at the end of day one.
Yeah. Freddie Likes was having diff problems. Delighted to be leaving, I'd say, at the end of the year.
The first lot of diff issues. I think it was the rear diff this time, but the one that put him out the next day, I think, was the front one.
Wow.
But Burns was second fastest in Brechner and Troskoy, which I always thought was quite impressive, given that by this point he must have been shitting himself, really. I mean, you know, you wouldn't be wouldn't be. So presumably not pressing on and not driving, well, driving within himself. And yet to still be second quickest, given the company, I thought was quite impressive.
Yeah.
I think what I find impressive is the fact that you have the ability to pronounce the stage names correctly. That's fantastic.
Well, I'm sure there'll be Welsh people on pretty soon. I mean, I don't think I've ever
pronounced one of those stage names right.
His time in Treskoad, though, buys into what you guys have been mentioning all along, like what we've highlighted in terms of his notes. That was in the dark, and you know, the detail that he was clearly putting in the notes would, you know, magnify itself in the dark.
Yeah. So onto day two, I guess. The morning the Burns had the issue with the spark plugs, was it?
Yeah, the actual quote was, "We took a spark plug out and saw it was damp," Burns added. "Fortunately, we had a kit of parts in the car and a routine to cope with this sort of situation. So we changed all the spark plugs and it started." That was obviously after they pushed it out of Parc Fermé.
Yeah, that was lucky, you know, and obviously no one issue, you know, considering they had a workaround for it. Mm-hmm. But not something you want to have happen. As you're trying to get the end of rally and get your first title,
he went through in good detail in his book, and he talked about stepping through the whole process, trying to keep himself calm. When you can imagine the pressure sitting there, start of the day, I know you're thinking, right, just being calm, clear, and trying to go through all the kind of routine.
Yeah, definitely.
It's actually something that I kind of, after obviously when I read the book about 7 million times. It's something I kind of kept close in him when I was competing, just to kind of keep the stress level down, don't get heightened up by the situation. Now, obviously, I'm probably 4 universes away from a world title drive, so the pressure doesn't really count. But
no, you were pretty calm. Any time I sat with you, you were always pretty calm, to be fair. I don't know, you didn't listen to anything. Was the intercom even switched on? Maybe that was it.
I don't know the switch. Anytime I hit the ignition switch on the control panel, it switched off the intercom.
Oh, that explains everything.
Slick wire. But genuinely, it's something that Burnsy's career and his book had a massive influence on me, and it's something I definitely took from his approach.
Yeah.
And I'm sure so many more did, but people far more accomplished in the sport than me.
Yeah.
Must have taken some self-resolve to think that this reliability will improve when I go to Peugeot next year.
Yeah, imagine that. the Japanese car being less reliable than the French one. You know, it doesn't happen too often, but anyway. That's just the main story from day two. Sainz had an incident on stage 11 where he went off into a group of spectators. No, fortunately, no one was killed, but I believe a good few were taken to hospital. So stage 11 was pulled after that, and then stage 12 was cancelled as well. And obviously, then Ford at that point decided to pull both Sainz and Mark Higgins out of the event. Art made an interesting point in the Australia episode. You know, would if McRae had still been going and this had happened, would they have pulled it? Again, it's just one of those what ifs. We just don't know. But just highlights again, you know, that the spectator control probably wasn't what it should have been in some spots.
Something kind of eerie about that as well. Martin Whittaker was obviously, you could see him kneeling down beside the car talking to Lewis Moy and Carlos. And Carlos was visibly upset, but Martin Whittaker was also the press officer at F1 at the time, of issuing the statement of Ayrton Senna's death, I think.
He was, in
Imola 94. Yeah. And it was just something there, when I watched it, I was like...
I didn't know that.
Sorry, that's after ringing a bell there now, actually, yeah. Jeez, I think you're right, Tammy, yeah.
They set up a helpline. I was doing, you know, Googling, because again, I was at Droskoid, and I remember it being cancelled after it'd gone through. And they set up a helpline that you could call to check if your loved ones had been clobbered, which obviously, luckily, was fairly minor as how things turned out. I think it was a broken arm for someone. But it gives an idea of how serious they thought it was going to be for a short while.
Yeah, Sainz was pretty rattled, as you would be. Jesus, that's like everyone's worst nightmare. You know.
It was all over the news on BBC at the time, because I remember being at home on the Saturday, constantly on page 360 on CFAX to try and get results. Because I suppose what we have to remember is, if you didn't have satellite TV, you were relying on Euronews on TG4 early in the morning to have some bit of a clip from the ISC footage, and CFAX in the afternoon then to kind of get your updates. And all you got was this report that science had gone off, stage cancelled. You know, it's home to the fact of how reliant we are now on our information that we have and the source that we can have of it. But what we had then, we just had to appreciate. But geez, it was heavy going, like even seeing it.
Even that, even moving kind of past, obviously, the direct impact, bringing it back, say, to the pressure that was piling on Burns at this point, even outside factors like that coming into your head, do you know?
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot piling up there. Like.
I don't know. I think from a mental perspective, Burns was having, you know, better than usual. And obviously, he wouldn't be human if he didn't have nerves in this situation. But he was well capable. Like, he'd won the Australian numerous times. It wasn't as if Joe had suddenly found himself in this situation. This is building up in a while. He'd been, you know, in a championship sort of contention before as well. And he was in charge. He knew what he was doing. You know, even despite all the contract stuff that was going on between Peugeot and Subaru at the time as well, you know, he was still able to put that at the back of his mind and just get on with it. And I think, you know, not a very difficult thing to do, to drive for 2.5 days and, you know, keep the championship stuff out of the front of your mind until as late as possible. I'd say pulling up to the start line of American Park there on the Sunday afternoon, I'd say, must have been fairly tense inside in the car, but in a nice way, you know, just the relief, I'd say, when they got past the finish line. And Joe, he uttered the famous line, "You're the best in the world," to Robert Reed, as you'd hear in the intro clip to this episode. It was fantastic to see it, like, and you know, his dad was there at the finish line, and his friends and family and stuff like that, you know. It was a culmination of a huge effort from Richard all throughout the years. As you've mentioned his book, William, this was Richard's life. This winning in this sport, this was him. Like, he didn't have any other ambition other than to do this. He sacrificed a lot when he was younger to do it. He put so much energy into it, brought so many new things to the sport. And it's kind of fitting that the 2001 season, with all its ups and downs, all the different things that happened, the amount of winners, the amount of, you know, competition there, the coverage, the hype around the whole thing, it really was fitting that Burns was the guy that came out on top.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The guy could have had two or three more titles to his name had things worked out differently. Obviously, you know, came to a very, very tragic end for him a couple of years later. But, you know, and a super guy. And it's only now we realize it. Again, you know, we can look back at the benefit of hindsight. You know, when you're young and impressionable, McRae is going to be the guy that grabs your attention. Or, like the Granum would say, because Granum was world champion the year before, or whatever. You know, you're always going to kind of err towards the big names like that, or like the Tommy. You know, you just assume. And again, Tommy had the Marlborough thing going on. Schumacher was dominating F1 at the time. Therefore, Ray Carroll must be good. Nobody taught Mitsubishi, though, unfortunately. But anyway.
Well, Freddie Loic's got a fifth fastest time in SS9.
Whoa! Slow down, Freddie.
Then it shot itself in SS2.
Yeah, there you go. Careful now. But anyway, I think this is fantastic. And looking through this whole series, looking at the rounds in the way we did, you know, we've dug out as much info as we can from, you know, the coverage and the different media around the time and speaking to the people involved. My appreciation for Richard Burns and Robert Reed's approach is huge. They just did a fantastic job, and some of the two most deserving guys, I think, this year. You know, their approach paid off.
I agree with you.
I think
and you mentioned there about the impact of different drivers on people over the years from a young age, especially like we were all at a very impressionable age. Like, for me, it's hands down the reason I decided I could take up the sport. I've mentioned this so many times before. Like, so, like, simple thing of, like, had he not risen to that height, or had Joe, had the thing go his way to get the title, would he have kind of, Joe, would his story be as well known, or would he just be another guy and around the WRC, whatever you call it, paddock, whatever you want to call it, do you know what I mean? So it's like there's a long lasting effect rather than just a single year's world title for a driver, do you know what I mean?
It's quite fitting in its own way that 2001 season is almost a microcosm of how Burns went about rallying. You know, it's quite understated, very neat, always there to grind out a decent result with, you know, the one victory and always seeing the bigger picture, which, you know, I suppose explains how he won it anyway. But it's quite fitting considering that's basically Burns in a nutshell as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah. It's a victory, I suppose, for hard work and resilience, really, and taking your thinking to a different level and just, you know, taking it, like you say, looking at the bigger picture, taking a step back at the broader scheme of things and looking at doing it in a different way. And in fairness, I would have held my hands up. At the time, I was very much a McRae fan. Still am a McRae fan. And my anger has been resurrected as to how stupid it was.
Yeah, we've got Tommy wants to leave now for the night.
No, I won't want to know. But I was also, equally, I was a Richard Burns fan because I think here in Ireland, because the BRC, you would always watch who the quick guys in the BRC were because at that period, you were still seeing some of the guys make the transition to the World Rally Championship and you'd see them come over and do the events in Ireland. They'd occasionally do the likes of Donegal very rarely, but Richard only ever did the Ulster, and Colin, we'd seen him do the Circuit of Ireland, and with McRae relationship with doing rallies in Ireland. So you had that affinity with these drivers, but Richard's approach and ultimately the way he won out, it's made all the more impressive now when you look back at it in detail the way we have. And I suppose it's really a good template for any young driver to examine and also take going forward.
It's also a kid from Oxfordshire as well. That's the thing that's always forgotten. This is not rallying Heartland by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. You know, I mean, England isn't generally anyway, but certainly not Oxfordshire, and the guy, or is it Reading? Certainly, he's from Rally M4. That's it, yeah.
But that's exactly the point as well, because like what I find quite inspirational about what Richard achieved, it's in Dave Williams' book, The Rallying's Would-Be King. The fact that he's, to a degree, an outsider in the sport, like I can totally testify to that. Like, I've done quite a number of rallies and I've been quite lucky to be somewhat successful as a navigator. I still feel a little bit like an outsider of that. And I can relate to that thing of you're not really from a rallying heartland, you know, that you have the shoe in to get in. And to see somebody climb the ladder the way he did makes it all the more impressive and heartening for anyone to look on to say that it can be done. It's going to be bloody hard.
Yeah,
the point you made there, but obviously not from a popular area. His family had no involvement in sport whatsoever, and it's definitely something I connected with a lot, because out of my family, is the only person in my family with any interest in cars or motorsport, and it just came out of the blue as far as my family are concerned. But I think at the time when I got hold of his book, and I was looking at it going, geez, I'm doing the same stuff here. I'm working, putting all my money in. This is fantastic. This is actually doable, do you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I think it's almost, there's almost a, you can, people can connect with that story a lot more. I mean, like, not to take anything away from McRae, but like son of Jimmy McRae, you know, and then with Alistair as well, you're a rallying dynasty.
Yeah.
Do you know?
At the time, they were the number one rallying family in the world, really, if you want to say that. You know?
And then you've Richard Burns coming from, as you said, cleaning gas station pumps. To get his money together to go rallying when he started out.
Yeah.
You know, it's a hell of a road.
Like, looking at the final standings for the championship. Okay, Granholm won the rally, Robin Peiro was second, and Burns got the third place he needed to finish. So fair play, you know, good showing from Pewter as well. They tied up the manufacturer's title. But just looking at the names on the standings, right? So, and I'll read them out in order. Burns, Conor McRae, Mackinnon, Robin Peiro, and Granholm tied for fourth.
Sainz, Auriol, Knizzi, Delacour, Solberg, Poras, Likes, Schwartz, Loeb, Redstrom, Gardemeister, Alistair McRae, Maca Martin, Tashiari. Like, that list alone, that's a pretty, pretty decent list.
That's like a greatest hits list, that's what that is.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. No, that's what I called rallying.
And this is
before we get to the teams cup where we've got Henrik Lundgaard. Oh wow! But the like that's the point I'm trying to get to. Burns won, arguably during 2001, arguably one of the most competitive years the sport had ever seen or ever will see. And this is kind of this isn't the final episode of the podcast. We have the chat with Robert Reid next week, and we'll do a kind of a recap and kind of a where they know sort of a thing for the final episode of the series. But this is, you know, just the Burns win, all those guys I've just named out there, that kind of, I suppose, just proves our point. Jamie, like, I suppose, what are your thoughts on it? Do you know, is the year as special to you as it is to us? Or?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think I didn't appreciate 2001 for what it was at the time, you know, because I was a kid of 13. And so I kind of took it as a given that each would be as hotly contested, even though they hadn't been done previously. But as I, you know, without wanting to sound like a stuck record, with the passage of time, you only realise how significant it was. And obviously, helps isn't the right word, but with what happened since to Richard and Colin, but Richard in this case, it lends it further significance and weight. You know, it's hard to view that Morgan Park ending with a little undercurrent of sadness, really, because he was so primed to do well. He had the innate ability and character to really succeed with those mid-noughties 2-litre WRC cars. And just fantastic year, fantastic season.
Yeah. No, that's any, and looking at the, you know, this was the way the sport was to develop, as we've said numerous times, and as you mentioned there, Jamie, it would have been fascinating, you know, later on through the 2000s said things worked out differently. But unfortunately, the top two guys there, you know, Burns and McRae, sadly no longer with us, but, you know, both passed away tragically within a couple of years of each other. And Burns actually, you know, he actually died on the fourth anniversary of his championship win.
And on the same day as George Best as well, which meant that he got completely overshadowed by his demise. You know,
like. Exactly, yeah, the papers are full of that, and you know, no disrespect to George Best, another fantastic sportsman, but that did mean that Burns did not get the recognition he deserved. But again, it's only through, I find myself anyway, looking back at this, that I really, my appreciation for him, well, I've always had a huge amount of respect for him, and you know, he would be one of the all-time greats in my eyes. It really just, you know, drives it home. This is brilliant. And that watch, if any, you try and watch that stage. He's on board from this event, or even any Burns on board. And if you can close your eyes and paint a picture of the road from his notes and the way Robert Reid calls him, if you can actually get a picture of the road from that, you're a lot better than I am. Because I tell you something, it's a really difficult thing to do, and it just shows the mental capacity that Burns had, that he was able to drive to those notes. And you know, take all the other stuff in, his driving style, keeping the car as straight as possible, the exit of corners. It was all the ingredients were there for him to, you know, to really be a strong contender for the years to come. But anyway,
And I think as well, Mark, as a pairing between the two of them. I mean, obviously you go through the detail of the notes, but and again, you'll hear a lot more detail from Robert Reid next week with this kind of stuff. But as a pairing, even someone looking outside, they clicked very well. Obviously, they were there together a long time. But I think their styles, obviously, I think they gelled quite well. Like, everyone talks about the relationships in the car being very quite close and that kind of thing, but you can see the differences with crews. Like, obviously, McRae and Grist were a great pairing, but there was a lot of fire between them a lot of the time. You just didn't see that with Barnes and Reid.
Yeah, no, it was they were a very, very strong partnership. So,
I mean, he was always a very cerebral driver, wasn't he, Burns? You know, you always got the impression there's a lot going on there.
Absolutely. But
I challenge anyone to watch that last stage of Morgan Park and not get hairs in your neck or a bit choked up. I'm mad enough to admit it every time I watch it gets me.
What's fantastic about that last stage as well, just looking at the format of the event, that they decided to run a rally with the last stage being a 27.9-kilometre stage. Like, you know, all to play for, you know. The rally could be decided on the turn of sixpence in there. It wasn't a 5K show pony stage like we see nowadays. That was a 27.93 full-fat stage.
Proper rally.
I mean, it did for Burns the very next year. You know, I was up the corner, three corners away down. It's when you get into the rhododendron bushes down towards, as it sort of like bleeds from forest into sort of, you know, Victorian parkland. And he went off about three corners up the stage from us. And it was a horrible, slow, being sucked into the bushes, just went wide and just, well.
Was it just beach there, Jamie? If I remember,
it was just beach, but it was down it was never getting out, you know, it was down a 6 foot bank, you know, and it was 40 degrees, you know, nose upwards, but completely fine, you know, the car was completely undamaged, and you could have walked, I mean, he walked past me and my dad spectating at the entrance to the stage, you know, it was an easy walk home, and well, yeah, as we all know, Malcolm Park has a horrible reputation, both, you know, for good reasons and bad reasons, really. But yeah.
Actually, Jamie, a question on that, like in terms of like the you're obviously spectating Saturday and Sunday. Can you give us a feel of what it was like? Just even obviously, we all know about the atmosphere, but getting around, the general feel. What was it like?
Not as well planned as it was subsequently, and I think indeed had been previously, when it was a lot more spaced out and you were given more freedom to do what you wanted. And again, I was 13 at the time, and I vividly remember basically just putting undue demands on my father's just to say, right, let's get to this stage that's halfway across the Brecon Beacons and we've got 45 minutes to do it, which, as we all know, is half the fun, but I imagine less fun when you're, you know, a dad and you've got some teenager to keep happy and a Ford KA going nuts. But yeah, I mean, good fun. I mean, it was very easy to see the atmosphere, you know, the big queues of people lining up in stages, not too bothered that the queue wasn't moving particularly quickly, you know, couldn't move for Salt Tires, couldn't move for Union Jacks.
Yeah, it's something like, especially at a young age, it's pretty simple things of visuals and sounds and smells would never forget.
Oh, it's just awesome. I mean, I was there for Friday afternoon, so I got the last of the decent weather, but then my overriding memory is just driving rain, raining sideways. And again, that's past the course because it's Wales in November and you expect it, but still, it was brutal and yet still completely worth the never dampening the spirits. Fantastic. I think, I mean, Resolven was particularly good on, I think it was the first stage of Saturday because it was the longest of the day. And that was a really good battle between Alistair and was it Armin Schwartz and the Skoda? They started taking time off each other.
Oh, yeah, they were pushing hard, trying to tie up the championship for the
Yeah, well, Alistair went wide on a corner, ripped the back of the accent off for a while, and that was a really good stage, just atmosphere-wise. You know, the stage lends itself to that kind of thing anyway because it's got a quick section, and then it winds its way in a series of hairpins up the hill. And then there's another flat-out blast with some sort of clear tree line at the time. And you could see, across the valley, you know, all the stereotypical GB rally stuff of hearing cars in the fog getting closer and closer.
Yeah. Did Alistair have an issue with his wipers at one stage that necessitated a bit of a...
Yes, the linkage shot itself, yeah, and they had to use the radio cable.
And David Senior's shoelaces as well, I believe, to try and get the wipers...
I had to do that once with a Focus. The exact same thing happened.
It actually happened to me and my sister's Fiat Punto years ago.
Did you take the football boots out of the boot and use the cases as well? Where it happened to me is actually, this is bizarre. It happened to me literally half a mile from where you live in Tipperary. It actually happened just down the road from your house.
Oh,
yeah.
Even if you called me, there'd be no help.
Yeah. Once again, you failed me.
Yeah.
Actually, do you know one point we missed there when we were talking about the celebrations of Burns? One man we missed was Dale Williams.
Mm. Oh, yeah. He's
mentor. Huge part of getting Burns to where he got to. So obviously, and you can see the emotion in his face. So something we should definitely point out, because his son now, Tom Williams, is rising up through the ranks.
There's a very good documentary on the, it's on the WRC Plus app, where they take one of Richard's road cars to
Goodwood. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's actually really
It's produced by John Desborough. His production company made it. It's fantastic. It's worth paying the €8 for the month to sit down and watch that. It's a very good documentary. David Williams gives some great insights, some lovely archive footage from Richard's days in the 205 challenge, things like that. It's a good watch.
Actually, a question for you, because I know it's something is it clear what happened to the car after scrutiny? Because I know his car was taken away from post event scrutiny, and he says he never saw it. Where did that car go?
That's a good one. They went for a tour of the Marble Arch the day after, and it was actually Petter's car he ended up using.
I'm assuming like most prototype cars have probably ended up in Ireland.
It actually did. Morris Gas had it for a while in 2003.
Was that the one that got the big slap in Lorgan Park?
No, that was one of McGarrity's 200 S8s that he had there.
A rally sport feature where I think you said that when you touched it, when they drove it through central London, right?
Yeah.
That's right,
yeah. That was after, yeah.
Probably with banging hangovers, that's a...
Underrated drives. I was just looking at something at the time.
Through Marble Arch with a hangover.
One of the great drives of the world. Driving to the Marble Arch. An absolute banging hangover. I think, obviously, it's very easy. Kind of, Richard Burns would have to be, it's drive of the season, really. But in terms of this rally, I was just looking down through some of the results, and David Higgins made a real charge on the final day. I know I'm going really left field on this, to win Group N and just finish outside the top 10. But also, Loeb and McShay were setting ridiculous times inside in the two Super 1600s. When you look at the conditions on the final day and the times that the guys were putting in, 14th, 15th fastest time in amongst World Rally cars, and we're talking 39... Group A, 8 cars, including more rally cars, started this event, and 40 in 4 cars. And these two Super 1600s, right up inside the top 15, setting times on the final day in the muddy conditions. An honourable note has to be made to those two performances there. Obviously, Sebastian won, but it has to be said, fantastic performances there.
Definitely.
Sebastian came in at 15th overall, right? That's not nothing. Yeah. Just above Stig in a Lancer.
Yeah.
Big future ahead of him for Loeb. Do you know, just again?
Thought you meant Bloomquist.
No one.
Just playing to Skoda for the Octavia, no?
Yeah. Do you know, nobody obviously at this point knew what was going to happen the next few years, but just interesting to know how many the influential guys were still around at that point from all the eras mixed together. Joe, like you said, there's Stig, you do on Guns and Loeb and Salberg and stuff coming up that were going to dominate for the next few years. And you had the guys who the established frontline guys like Mack and McRae and Burns and stuff. It was just brilliant. Brilliant era. I'd love to have been there at the side of stage two there, towards the end of stage two on Friday morning, seeing McRae go past. I'd say that would have been something else.
It's obviously one thing that I'd say probably hurts the most as a rally fan. Lucky enough to see McRae when he came to Killarney in 2005, but having never seen Burns in action.
I think I probably took that for granted. I mean, I saw Burns, from 96 onwards, all the Burns victories in Wales just as a given, really.
I
kind of feel it's funny, you look back and at the time I suppose I saw the World Rally Championship in 2001 as it was a godsend. This was something really special. It gave you something to look forward to. And, to be able to have seen, Richard Burns and Colin McRae came over here to do these show events, but we were able to see them on our doorstep here. And it's funny now when you look back, all these years later, how privileged we were to be able to see talent like that within our lifetime, be able to witness it there. Not that we're, we talk about Group B, Group E, we're stepping back generations beyond ourselves. We were all in prams or not even born.
Yeah.
We were able to witness this, even if it was, you know, delayed highlights in our lifetime.
No, we'll be talking about this for, you know, I'll probably be telling my grandkids still about this, like, and they'll be like, "Oh my god, you chose to do a podcast about it, you absolute lunatic. Leave us alone." Shut up about it.
But anyway, we'll be written off the family tree for being embarrassing nerds.
Yeah. But anyway. That pretty much wraps us up for this week. As I mentioned, next week we've got Robert Reid on, and the following week we'll do kind of a series recap, kind of a where they know sort of a what sort of thing for the crews and the other people involved. So make sure and tune in for those. So Jamie, thanks very much for joining us this week. It's been great company and fantastic to hear.
I loved it.
Yeah, fantastic to hear the stories from someone who was there at the time. And obviously, as I mentioned already at the start of the podcast, check out the Gravel Crew on Facebook and other social media if you haven't already. But it's pretty much the only reason I'm on Facebook these days. Just want to give a quick shout out as well. The intro tune, if anyone's wondering, is "Small Boats for Strange Seas" by Arthur Itis, who you can find on Bandcamp and Spotify and those other things as well. So check that out. He's a good friend of mine. He's got lots of those kind of ambient sort of tunes. So pretty cool. Okay, so yeah, that's it. So from myself, Maris, and from the guys, thanks very much for listening as usual. And we'll talk to you again next week. Bye for now.